Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. Are you having problems with your homeowners association? Just what is a homeowners association? Does it only seem that they're everywhere? How does a homeowners association come into being? Can you just opt in if you don't live quite right there? Can you opt out? What if you fully buy into the homeowners association? You fully believe in it and decide, I'm going to join the board. Just what experience is in store? Do good homeowners associations make good neighbors? As always, we want you, our most important guest, to join in the conversation. So give us a call. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our attorney guests are here to educate and inform, but they can't give you specific legal advice for specific cases they haven't seen. But they're here to help. They're here to try to give you some guidance as you try to sort out these legal principles. Joining us tonight is Ron Rohde. Whether discussing Lemon Law arbitration or patents or any one of a thousand things, Ron's the guy I've yet to stump with anything legal, or really much of anything. Ron can tell us from personal experience what it means to serve on a board of a homeowners association. Also joining us tonight from San Mateo, attorney Paul Lee has over 22 years of experience in construction defect litigation, condominium law, commercial business litigation, real estate law, and yes, homeowners association law. He's assisted homeowners associations obtain multi-million dollar settlements, represented landlords in lease disputes, and represented contractors and subcontractors in contract disputes. Ron, Paul, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Who'd like to jump in first with the first question of the night? Just what is a homeowners association?
Well, I guess I'll answer that real quick. A homeowners association can be is typically a nonprofit mutual benefit corporation that's registered with the Secretary of State, and the homeowners association is basically responsible for the common area of the subject property, and a homeowners association is run by a board of directors. They're an entity that owns the common area, and they are responsible for maintenance responsibilities as well.
So before I let you off so easy, I've got to ask you the follow-up question. How do homeowners associations come into being?
Well, they are usually created by a developer of a new, let's just say condominium complex or townhome or planned development. And they're usually registered with the Secretary of State. There are governing documents that are created, such as bylaws, as well as CC&Rs. And once the developer starts selling the individual units, every member becomes every purchaser becomes a member of the homeowner association that's running the premises.
Yeah, another way they come into being is what was called a condominium conversion back in the 70s and 80s. There were a lot of those where they would take an apartment building, kick everybody out, and turn it into a condo, and then start selling the apartments off as condos.
And how do the CC&Rs fit in? And for those that don't know, I'm asking about a document called Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions. How does that fit into the mix?
Well, the CC&Rs are usually created by the developer, and they can be amended over the years by the association. But the CC&Rs are the primary governing documents. They're I guess, the equivalent of the Constitution for a homeowners association. These are the rules that we go by. These are the responsibilities of owners. These are the responsibilities of the board of directors. And these are the rules that we're going to live together.
Yeah, so the governing documents include the CC&Rs, the covenants, what is CC condition, anyway, and the bylaws. The bylaws are kind of how the governing directors conduct themselves. The CC&Rs apply to the people who live there. And then there's the rules that are put together, voted on, promulgated by the directors for day-to-day activities that aren't really part of the CC&Rs. They're more like statutes, I guess.
It seems that every housing development today involves a homeowners association. How did this become, you know, how did they become such a vital part of development, such a vital part of building?
Quite simply, it's a cheaper form of dwelling. It's less expensive. You have, in a typical condominium or homeowners association, you'll have also a manager, who is a very important part of this, who takes care of the day-to-day maintenance and all just sort of a lot of the things a homeowner doesn't have to do anymore is done by the manager or the HOA association. That is, they maintain the grounds, they do repair, they do the landscaping, clean the pool, whatever has to get done. And that takes a huge burden off of the actual owners of the property. So not only is it cheaper to have a structure that has a lot of condos, sort of the efficiency of scale, you also have a management that takes care of all of the kind of the drudgery tasks of a homeowner.
And would the same hold true when you're talking about a development of single-family homes? Maybe in order to have some shared shared benefits, whether it's a pool or a park or whatever it may be, somebody to take care of it?
Yes, I'm referring mostly to a condominium, but you have townhouses or an association like that. You also have other types of developments that are common interest developments, TICs, the tenants in common, and condominiums. I'm most familiar with the condominiums, having been a board member for about 18 years and a president of the board for the last 15. So I can kind of address that a little bit better, but they're all, again, efficiencies of scale where you've kind of separated a lot of the maintenance of the property and the day-to-day taking care of the property from the actual ownership of the property. So something like a townhouse, maybe only the streets and some of the ancillary buildings like pools or gyms are taken care of by the HOA, whereas in a condominium, almost the entire building is maintained and the homeowner is only responsible for whatever's from the paint inside. And from the paint outside is the HOA's responsibility.
Generally, what does a homeowners association do?
Your turn.
So the
Paul.
Homeowners association is operated by a board of directors, a voluntary board of directors, and then sometimes they'll hire a property manager. So what the homeowner association does is they collect dues to pay taxes, and they also collect dues to for maintenance purposes, whether it's getting a new roof, landscaping, pool maintenance. Those are all costs that the association is typically responsible for, depending on what's in the governing documents. And in order to do that, they need to collect association dues.
They also
So.
set the amount of the dues from one year to the next, and they do the accounting. Well, they'll hire a management company to do the accounting for them, or they'll do all the accounting. It's on a spectrum. Sort of, as a friend of mine used to put it, people buy a condominium so they don't have to mow the lawn. Instead, they sit around in board meetings talking about mowing the lawn.
So how do these things work? How do they govern themselves?
So typically, when the developer creates association, he first assigns board of directors, but then eventually, when everyone moves in, board of directors, there's an election held, and depending on the bylaws, that'll tell you how many board of directors there are. And then elections are held where the members vote for the for who they want to be on the board of directors. And then the board of directors are responsible for executing their responsibilities under the CC&Rs.
So, and a lot of this is also governed by the statutes, that have been,
The Davis-Sterling
yeah,
Act.
that have been passed more and more often to typically control the board of directors and what they can and cannot do, to kind of regulate the elections, regulate a lot of board of directors' activities. So, I don't know, does that answer your question?
Pretty much, but let's take a step back. Why is it that some folks have a great relationship with their homeowners association? They're doing all these things for them, and they really appreciate it. Others have a very distrustful view of their homeowners association. They don't see them as their community, but rather people on a board they really don't trust. Why is that, if we know?
I think there are a lot of reasons. Some of it will come down to let's say a mismatch between the board of directors and the expectations of the homeowners. Sometimes you have a very problematic homeowner who just doesn't really belong in an association like this. And sometimes you'll have a board member who has a complex of power complex and wants to be sure that everything is done by the rule, and or done by what their conception of the rule is. And I think that a good, probably more important question is what makes a good board or what makes a good association. And that's when the board members and the homeowners are sort of on the same page and working together and cooperating to make everything better, rather than each trying to run their own personal agenda. Perhaps Paul has seen something else.
Now, one of the issues that I see is that some people, owners, may believe that the HOA and the HOA's rules are too, I had the word in my mind, but too much, they're too controlling. A lot of owners think just because they bought into the place, they can do whatever they want. And they don't understand that, especially in a condominium setting, you live very close with your neighbors. You're not an island and isolated, and you have to deal with your neighbors. And if you're unwilling to do that, that's when tension and hostility is created. So I think people just need to understand we don't live a mile apart from one another. We maybe it's 2 feet. And people have to learn how to get together and work together if they're going to live in such close proximity.
Well, across a wall, you're only 5 inches if it's a 2x4 wall. So you have all sorts of problems that can arise from that, just noise issues, people being sloppy about taking out their garbage, or lots of cooking odors in the building. So people can become very annoying to each other. Unfortunately, it's not really up to the board of directors necessarily to solve all those problems for them. And then you have the homeowners who want to do something with their unit that can't be done according to the CC&Rs. So then it becomes the task of the HOA or the board of directors to approve or disapprove what has been done. And as I try to explain to my board and to the homeowners that come in front of the board, you know, I can only approve something that is that the governing documents allow me to do. That is, I have only so much authority, we the board have only so much authority to give approval as in the governing documents. So I have to direct them back to the governing documents and say, here's what they say, here's what you're doing, and here's the differences. And there have been many times when I've been very sympathetic towards the homeowner and wanted to give them an approval or help them out, or I know what they're doing, I understand, but I can't do it because I don't have the authority under the governing documents to allow them to do things. Sometimes they think I'm being a dictator and just kind of trying to enforce my own opinion. But and I think a lot of times that you have to have a board that is sympathetic to the homeowner and realizes that each of those board members is also a homeowner and might come in front of the board, and how would they feel if they were in front of the board? On the other hand, the homeowner has to understand that there is a very limited authority that is in the board, and the board is restricted by the CC&Rs and the bylaws and the rules that have been put together up to that point. And maybe a lot of this conflict comes from just a misunderstanding.
There was an episode of the Gary Shandling Show years ago where this stuff came up, and they had townhouses. They were made to look very, very similar, had a code that required uniformity both in structure and in the colors that they were painted. And he decided to put a front porch so he could sit out, and the CC&Rs didn't call for that.
Yeah. And I've had cases very similar to that where somebody wanted to do something unique with their front door, and I had sympathy with that. I like what they did, but they can't because I can't approve it. I and the board can't approve it because we don't have the authority to do so. And the real problem then is if we approve something for one board member or for one homeowner to do to their unit, which is not according to the CC&Rs, then we, the board, are subject to all sorts of problems from all the other owners. And there can be litigation resulting from that. So simply allowing somebody to do something that's not allowed can subject us to litigation just as fast as prohibiting something that we have to prohibit.
So I don't live in a development that has a homeowners association. If I want to do something to my house that falls outside of what's expected in my neighborhood, I can go to the planning commission. They can actually provide procedures for me to get the neighbors to sign off and to make some kind of a variance. Is there a parallel process with a homeowners association where somebody who wants to add on that front porch or put on that unusual front door can go somewhere and say, hey, how about it? We're all better off.
It depends on the association. There are associations that are usually have written into either the bylaws or the CC&Rs a committee, an architectural control committee or something with a name similar to that, which is then given powers, again, under the governing documents to make decisions on variances from the from the standard of the rules. For example, a door that's a different color or windows that are a different type. So, and the HOA itself, the board of directors, can change, can amend the governing documents or can amend the rules or the CC&Rs as necessary.
So,
well, let me just put a caveat on that one. To amend the CC&Rs, it actually has to go to a membership vote, not just the board of directors.
So we would put it out to all of the people that live there, or presumably all the owners there?
Yeah, if an association decides to amend or restate their bylaws or CC&Rs, that has to go through a rewrite process, and eventually the members vote, because it's usually written in the CC&Rs to, in order to amend the CC&Rs, X amount of percentage of the members have to approve the new changes.
And generally it's the board members that have to drive this, though sometimes the owners can drive something like this.
I've been asked to pass along a hypothetical. One of the upstairs homeowners accidentally lets the bathtub overflow, and it causes water damage to the unit below and to some common areas. Who's responsible for repairing the damages?
I would like to hear Paul's on this one, since you're taking my hypothetical.
Your hypothetical is just that the bathtub overflowed, where a homeowner is just letting the water run. So in that situation, I would say that the homeowner is responsible for all the damage that results from the overrunning bathtub. But that's kind of an easy hypothetical.
Actually, it's maybe not quite so easy. And that's because we also have insurance. And so the homeowner whose negligence caused the damage still has a claim on the insurance. So now the homeowner who caused the damage claims insurance to protect for liability and for all the damage to their own home. And the HOA's insurance premiums go up as a result of this. So I've had I've actually had several cases of this where somebody did exactly this, fell asleep, water filled up the sink and flooded the two units below. There's also another case where the plumbing inside the walls leaked and caused damage. So there, it's the HOA's responsibility and expense, but ultimately, the entire HOA pays for it.
So I've actually encountered a situation where it's the plumbing inside the walls is maybe the source of the water intrusion. And that type of situation, you have to look at the CC&Rs because many CC&Rs are rewritten to pass on the responsibility to the actual homeowner, depending on what pipe or what unit that is being serviced by that pipe or that may have caused the leak. So you have to look at the CC&Rs very carefully.
I've been the tenant below that pipe before. I have a little experience with that as well. Let me turn it over to Cedric from Upper Market. Cedric, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Cedric, can you hear us?
I think Cedric is dealing with a water flood in his unit there.
Cedric, you're welcome to call back. That may be you coming through now. We're happy to take your call. Ultimately, is a board as good as its members? I mean, ultimately, a board can be very good when people do their homework and pay attention, or maybe not so good if they're not getting engaged between meetings?
I think if you've got an active board that's very interested in the HOA, you've got a great board, you've got and you have some really good neighbors.
I think what makes a good board is, first of all, if you have a kind of a variety of skills, you need somebody who has a good financial head to take a look at the numbers. You need somebody who knows something about building because you're ultimately dealing with buildings. You need somebody that knows something about laws or has some feel for laws and legal issues because you're often running into legal issues. So, and you need somebody who has some artistic talent, who can help with decorating ideas or how to arrange the furniture, say, in the lobby or something like that, or select furniture in the lobby if you have that. So a good set of skills makes up a good board. You also need a board that...
And hopefully that's not all one person, because somebody with all those skills going at the same time probably has no friends.
Yeah. And it'd be surprising to find somebody with all of those skills. It also helps if you have good management, because the manager can make a huge difference in the way the board runs, or way the work gets done, and the board really has to be able to rely on their manager. So those are all good parts of it. Ultimately, though, you still need participation by the owners. And that's been one of the biggest problems I've seen in many boards. There's just sort of the owners are, we're here, take care of things. We don't really want to bother. We don't want to show up at meetings. We don't want to vote. We don't want to do anything. We just want you to take care of it. And then when anything goes wrong, we're going to come and complain.
And it is a thankless job. Let me turn it back to Cedric. Welcome to your legal rights.
Oh, that's much better. Thank you. I couldn't hear you last time. I put up a flagpole in my second home in Napa, and the Sagewood HOA management said, I put up a nice pride flag, and they said, I can't have that flagpole or that flag. And I read the CC&Rs, and there's nothing in there that says that, and I just think it was homophobic. And I would like to know what kind of recourse I have against them.
Well, I don't think I'm going to give you a list of cause of actions after a 1 minute conversation, but if your CC&Rs don't restrict flags, I don't see the basis for doing that, you know, so.
I would invite the HOA, the board of directors, to show you within the governing documents where some support for why you can't do that. That would be the first thing.
Yeah, typically, you can request a meeting or a private meeting with the board and to see if you can resolve some sort of internal dispute. And depending on the situation, they're required to meet with you. Or you could bring it up at the open meetings or open meeting session of a board meeting. So
you can also write them a letter and ask for information and support for their negative response to your flagpole.
But there's also a question about whether the CC&Rs restrict there being a flagpole there in the first place, as well as whether they could restrict content or not.
Well, yeah, okay, so you're talking about content and the flagpole itself. So, Cedric, did they actually ask you to take it down because of what the flag said, or because you're just not allowed to have a flagpole in the first place? Or did they tell you?
Looks like we lost Cedric. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Why do some folks experience a symbiotic relationship with the homeowners association while others see them as a problem? While they take good care of the place, why does my HOA maintain such control over our activities? Is there a benefit to joining the HOA board to better understand the goings-on? Tonight's guests, Paul Lee and Ron Rohde, are here to give you a view from the lawyer as well as from the director of a homeowners association. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, you're outside of San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in the conversation. And gentlemen, sometimes when somebody is listening and they want to ask a question, they will send it in by email or by text. I have one such question right now. This caller who's asked not to be identified is asking, what does the Attorney General do to enforce violations of Davis-Sterling? The property owners in their development have submitted many complaint letters that were virtually ignored by the Attorney General's office. He goes on to say, when does or what types of violations of Davis-Sterling does the California Attorney General enforce? And asking if either of you have experience with the Attorney General enforcement of the Davis-Sterling Act.
I personally have not dealt with the Attorney General enforcing individual CC&Rs or the Davis-Sterling Act against a homeowner association. I have never had to deal with that.
I've also never had to deal with that, so I'm afraid I'm not sure where they come in, other than, the person said that many people have contacted the Attorney General, and the Attorney General's done nothing, so I don't know.
So if they're relying on the Attorney General and the Attorney General is not doing anything, then the homeowner, him or herself, can actually try to bring an individual lawsuit against the HOA for things that they perceive to be incorrect, some sort of breach of fiduciary duty, negligence type of situation. So
let me take a call from Ned in Santa Cruz. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you fine.
Great. So this is a question back to plumbing again. So there was a problem with draining in the condo that I own, and they told me that it had to be redirected from the sink to the wall. And then I was told that the HOA would take care of that because it was tying into the building's drain system. That was over a year ago, or just about a year ago. And then I just recently got a bill from a plumber for $2,000 for the work that was done. And all they say is the drainage under the sink. And the HOA is telling me that I'm responsible for that. I never gave an approval for it. I never got a bid on it. It just seems like, wait, did they authorize that? If they authorize that, can they still make me pay for it?
I really hear a couple of questions here.
This goes back to what caused the leak. And who's responsible for that building component? So that's the first thing that you need.
There wasn't a leak. It was just that it didn't drain well. So I had a plumber come out a couple of times to clear the drain. And then I was told that it was because of the angle of the pipe that had to be replaced because it was wrong to start with. And that's why I had the repeated time. So there was no leak involved.
And where was the pipe that they were replacing? Was it inside your unit?
Yes. And then tied into the unit. Yeah, it was inside my unit, but tied into the building's drain system.
So typically, if it's a building component that's in the airspace of your particular unit, you're responsible for those components. But then,
yeah,
is that an original pipe? Is it some sort of you're going down a slippery slope if we go down to like, is it a construction defect or which I don't think we need to do, but is that a pipe that was there originally and had never been altered?
Yes. As far as long as I've owned the condo, which is, 8-10 years now.
Was it under your sink inside, as Paul said, inside the airspace, somewhere inside the paint on the walls, or was it on the other side of the paint?
Both, because it was under the sink that drained into the wall.
Okay.
And so it had to be reconnected to the building drainage.
The next thing you have to do is take a look again at the CCNRs and bylaws to see who is responsible for the pipe inside the walls. And there are some CCNRs where the homeowner is responsible for the wall pipe inside the walls as well as inside the airspace, and others it's only inside the airspace. It depends on your CCNRs and your bylaws.
Is there potentially another angle on this in the sense that the Homeowners Association, in fact, having heard from Ned, went ahead and contracted with a plumber themselves and sent them out? Does that by chance give them any liability?
If they think it was an emergency.
My question, because I never had a chance to get a bid on it or see, it was out of my hands and I haven't heard from them for a whole year. And now they're saying I owe up. Pricey thing, $2,000 for one pipe.
So what I think that the HOA probably did was say, this is an emergency repair. We don't have time. We got to get it fixed now. And so that's probably what happened. Instead of getting multiple bids, if the HOA believes that this is your responsibility, but then they paid the bill up front, they may try to seek what's called a reimbursement assessment from you. So what you need to do is probably just request a meeting with the board and try to figure out if you can allocate the responsibilities differently. If not, if it's only $2,000, that's a small claims matter, or the association may just put in a reimbursement assessment lien on your property.
Is there a default position if the CCNRs don't specify where the responsibility ends?
The Davis-Sternley Act has a pretty definition as well, but I think it's better to have the CCNRs, so it's much more clear.
In this case, I don't think there was an emergency. Weeks later, or at least several weeks, even more, because I believe they had to notify everybody they were going to cut into the building, to the drainage system for the building. So they had to schedule that and notify people for that period of time. So there was no emergency. And I mean, again, come back to the idea that I never got a bid. So, I mean, I don't know if that's a fair price or, they're the ones that contracted.
The first thing you need to do is take a look at your CCNRs. In the definitions section, you'll find a definition of what the common space is. Take that definition and apply it to this case and see if the repairs were done to the common areas or to the unit. And if it was done to the common areas, it's generally accepted that that would be the responsibility of the HOA to pay that. Invite the HOA to explain to you why it is they think that you owe the money, because they have the burden at this point to do that. And compare that with the CC&Rs and whether or not you think that's supportable. And as Paul said, you can take this to a neutral third party called a judge in a small claims court to get it all straightened out for you. In the worst case, that's for $2,000. That's well within their jurisdiction, and it's a lot cheaper than hiring a lawyer.
So could it be both? I'm like mutual responsibility because it's tying into the building, but some part of it is also in my private space.
It very well could be. And that's why you have to take a look at the definition of the common area space. And that should be in the CC&Rs near the beginning of the CC&Rs. There's usually a definition section that says this is what a unit is, this is what common area is, this is, and all sorts of definitions.
Is it a good idea for him to follow up with that plumber and find out just what they found?
Definitely. You should get an invoice from the plumber that gives a kind of a detailed description of what they did. If not, go in and demand that the plumber give you, if you're going to be the one paying for it, you're entitled to a detailed itemized description, including parts, materials, labor, etc.
It's also probably helpful to know whether he says something was stuffed down your sink that shouldn't have been, as opposed to where it fed into the common line deep into the walls. There was a problem there. Knowing one of those things might be helpful as well.
Yeah, I don't know what the construction of your unit is and whether or not there are other people sharing the common walls. But this is often a problem where you have multiple people sharing a common wall and some common drainage, and you don't really know where the foreign object came from that plugged the drain. The HOA typically is responsible in that kind of a case, again, unless the CC&Rs say otherwise.
Okay. Last question about that is, if the bill has on it that it's the HOA is being billed, so it's not being billed to me directly, but the HOA is telling me that it's not my responsibility, is there nothing in terms of a legal analysis that says, wait a minute, you guys have contracted with them, I never signed anything, I never gave a approval for that?
And again, it depends on what the CC&Rs say.
I understand that the first person who bought into that place in the unit that you have signed off on the fact that they're CC&Rs and they joined it, and they can't pass on a better right to you than they had themselves to pass on. So the CC&Rs are attaching to all the units, presumably from the very beginning. And knowing what they say will tell you everything.
Okay.
More information is better.
But at the end of the day, it's up to them to convince you, or to show the burden of proof is on them to show that you owe the money, since the bill went to them.
Yeah, so the association may have paid the bill and now they're looking for reimbursement from you.
Okay, well, I have scheduled a meeting to talk to them, but I'll try to review the CC&R first, so I'm better informed about it.
I wish you the best of luck, and thank you for joining us in your legal rights. And with
Thank
that, let me turn it over to John in Oakland. You're on the air. Welcome to your legal rights.
Hi. Good show, you guys. I have a question that may be off subject a little bit. I'm a contractor, and I get invited to quote on work at condos very often, but my insurance won't cover me for that work. I have a regular, you know, pretty hefty liability policy. I have a separate workers' comp policy for my workers. So I'm pretty well covered, but they will not cover me. Well, the liability policy won't cover me for work on condominiums, and I have to turn away the work. And I'm just curious if you guys know anything about that. One thing that happens sometimes is the owner or the homeowners association, whoever is acting as the owner, provides what they call an owner-controlled insurance policy, and that lets me do it when they're providing the liability insurance. But I'm just curious if you guys know why that's that way.
Yeah, this is a problem with insurance that I think we're experiencing all over the state, and it's just one more way that the insurance companies seem to be trying to cut back on their liability. So I don't know what to say yeah. to you about that, other than maybe if you want the work, then you may have to shop around to a different insurance company. But this is very disturbing that insurance companies are just making it that much more difficult and expensive for HOAs to obtain maintenance services by withdrawing their willingness to insure contractors.
From the insurance company's perspective, they're looking at it thinking, if you make a mistake in that situation at a condominium, it may affect a lot more people and cost a lot more money versus the same mistake in a single family home. So you may find that you have to go to a different insurer, maybe a more expensive insurer that's willing to take on that liability.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what the owners end up doing when, you know, there's a rehab going on the common areas of a condo. They experience enough contractors declining to bid on it that they go out and get what they call, an OSIP, an owner-controlled insurance policy.
So, is this across the board on condos, or is it particular areas, such as ones they consider to be in a fire hazard zone?
No, it's across the board, and it's been that way for a long time. It's not a very new thing. It's been that way for at least a decade. So I don't know. A lot of times when I'm declining to bid something, I don't know what to tell the owners. I don't have any more detail than that, other than just my insurer won't cover me for that. And then every once in a while, somebody does come to me where they have the insurance part covered. That's more often on a new construction project, new construction of a condo project there's also contractor controlled insurance policy. I'm a subcontractor, so sometimes a general contractor gets what they call a CCIP, which is contractor controlled insurance policy. And in either of those cases, I'm fine. I'm able to bid, and it actually saves me money because I don't have to provide liability insurance in those situations. But it feels like there's some reason why insurers feel like there's more risk or more liability somehow associated with working on condos. And, maybe it has something to do with the structure of the condo board or homeowners association, or I don't know, but I thought there might be some hint here.
Well, yeah, as Jeff just pointed out, if you're doing plumbing on a third floor of a condominium, the liability then is not only for the unit that you just did the plumbing work on, it's if your pipe breaks, it can cause a flood. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage,
yeah.
which I've seen, to three
yeah.
units, especially when you start having to replace flooring and wall panels and replace an entire
yeah.
bathroom or kitchen. That could be
yeah.
$100,000 per unit.
Yeah, but again, if it's an apartment building and it's owned by an owner, it could be a similar situation. I'm working on the third floor of an apartment building.
Yes.
But if it's rental property that's owned by an owner, my insurer doesn't have any problem with that. So. I don't know.
Well, that sounds like maybe you should discuss that with the insurer, because it doesn't make you're right. That does not make sense. And why they would single out condos as opposed to apartment buildings, quite simply because a lot of condos, certainly the one where I'm a board member in Los Altos, it's a condo conversion. It was once an apartment building. So the risk is the same for an apartment as that condo, for example.
You might talk to an insurance broker that deals more with contractors and see if they have ideas about an alternate insurer that you can go to.
Yeah. I've never
yeah.
run into this as a board member, but maybe my I'll check with my manager and see if he's run into this.
Yeah, I bet you'll find that some contractors decline to quote on, and maybe a majority of them actually decline to bid on your work. I know it's common, and I'm not the only one. I know lots of my peers do have the same situation.
And that may be.
Anyway, I appreciate.
Yeah, but they've never. I've never heard them say the reason is, and then the reason.
Yeah, I've not heard that either. Yeah, exactly. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Anyway, I appreciate the show. I appreciate your time. Keep it up. Great work.
Well, I appreciate the heads up. I'm going to look into this.
And thank you for joining us. And let me turn it to Michael in San Mateo. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Michael, are you still with us?
Hello?
Michael, welcome. You're on the air. Or not. Michael, time permitting, we're happy to take your call, but it doesn't sound like we have it just now. Let me turn it to Peter from Florida. Peter, it's been a couple of weeks. Welcome back.
Yeah, I'm glad you recognize me. You know, I think of like the most relevant thing I can think of in my area, because I just checked, it was 4 years ago. And I'm wondering if it's a case study, that Surfside condominium collapse.
We all remember that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, did you discuss that? Because that seems like that would be like the textbook, like what happens when like engineers and flawed design and building inspection and the homeowners association doesn't want to pay for it. Is there no agency that can say, no, you don't have the option to vote to postpone this? You can't kick this, you can't kick this can down the road. This building's going to collapse. It must be fixed now. Is there any such institution that can kind of take control of those situations
before
this doesn't happen again?
Before either of my guests even begin to answer this question, I'm going to alter your question a little bit. Is there any such entity to take control within California? Because my guests are California lawyers and probably shouldn't be answering a question about what structures are in place in Florida.
I'm going to start with the HOA. The board members have a fiduciary duty to the owners to take care of this and to keep this sort of thing from happening. And to the extent that they breach that duty, then there are other agencies within the state that come into play. But as a threshold, it's the HOA, the board members, that do have a duty to take good care of the property.
So there is no California agency that oversees all HOAs, but what we have instead is the Davis-Sterling Act. And in this, what's analogous to the Florida case, maybe the balcony case in Berkeley, where a bunch of students were piled onto a balcony and then it collapsed and several students passed away. Starting this year, California requires all balconies to be inspected now every 9 years. So I think that's how California responds. By enacting certain rules and regulations, as opposed to having a government agency overseeing all HOAs.
Yes, and our HOA is now going through that inspection, and it's not an inexpensive process. It's just going to drive our dues up. And that's assuming that we don't even find anything that needs to be repaired at this time.
And unfortunately, incidents of that are becoming more frequent, even here in California.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
There is a local the worst thing I think a homeowner could do, well, I don't know if it's the worst thing, but if a homeowner were looking for some sort of agency, they could maybe contact city code enforcement to see if something was wrong. But that's the only thing I can think of right now. I don't think code enforcement would do a lot, but that's the only thing I can think of if you're asking for a government agency.
Well, consider, if this was your home, then you would be responsible for taking care of this. And what you are is a homeowner in a HOA, and you have tasked your board with taking care of the things that you would otherwise take care of. But that doesn't really relieve you as the owner of the responsibility to stay informed as to what your board is doing and to look critically at your own unit, because at the end of the day, it's your unit and you're the one who loses the money if things go south. So I'm back to the owners need to participate in the governance of the building. And when they do, when they help out, it makes it a lot easier for the HOA, for the board of directors, because at the end of the day, they're all working, they all have the same goal, and that's to make the place as safe and as in as good a condition as possible.
You know, the bottom line is if there's 100 people that own the place, you have 100 different interests, and presumably everybody's 1% responsible. Now, there may be some liability of a board, or it may be that the CCNRs absolve them of liability.
No, the CCNRs typically don't. However, there is an errors and omissions insurance to protect the board members. Otherwise, nobody would ever serve. So,
but maybe not enough to cover a high-rise.
Maybe not.
Peter, always good to talk to you. Sorry, we are out of time, but it is good to hear from you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 San Francisco Bay Area, where we've once again talked about your relationship with your homeowners association. Our guests tonight have been Ron Rohde of Mariposa and Paul Lee of San Mateo. Our final guest tonight has been all of you. Our show tonight has been produced by yours truly. Please join us again next week on Your Legal Rights, as we will discuss animal rights. But no matter what we're discussing, always we take your calls and answer your questions. And that's right here on Your Legal Rights, Wednesday nights at 6 o'clock. A big thanks to tonight's guests, Ron Rohde and Paul Lee, and to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Have a good night and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.